Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Since 1983, Eddie Trunk has been the voice for fans of rock, hard rock, and heavy metal. A best-selling author, host of TV's That Metal Show, and seven national radio shows, including Trunk Nation, daily on Sirius XM.
Interesting.
Eddie offers the world his news-making interviews, passionate analysis, honest commentary, and who knows what else. So welcome to the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Trunk, and it's time for another episode of the Eddie Trunk Podcast, which is new every Thursday via podcast1.com and iTunes. Thank you for listening, downloading, and streaming as we settle in for another week and a great interview I think you are really going to enjoy with a total icon if you are a rock fan, one of the pioneering rock bands of all time, Rock and Roll Hall of Famers, long overdue, by the way. But a band that I just spent a bunch of time with on tour in Mexico. I'm talking about Deep Purple. And for our podcast this week, my exclusive interview with the band's lead singer, Ian Gillan. And one of the things that I was much looking forward to doing while I had this opportunity to tour with Deep Purple throughout Mexico was to talk to Ian Gillan and Ian Pace extensively. Ian Pace, especially because he is the only guy that has been a part of Deep Purple for all of the band's 50 years of existence. And I did do that interview, and I will bring that to you on a future podcast where we go through everything from Jolyn Turner to Glenn Hughes to David Coverdale to Tommy Bolin to the pre-Ian Gillan version of Deep Purple. Ian Pace has seen it all. And we'll get that interview up for you in the next couple of weeks. But this week, I wanted to get Ian Gillan on. We conducted this interview. I forget what city we were in Mexico. And it's a good 45 minutes or so conversation with him. Just a wonderful man. I just had such an amazing experience. The guy is 74 years old and still sings really, really well. For his age, there are some things vocally he's just not going to do at this point in his career, which is understandable. Not going to be singing Child in Time anytime soon, but we had a wonderful dinner. He was nice enough to invite me to dinner. We spent 4 hours having a dinner one night in Mexico, and I was just like a sponge hearing everything from the guy. And, you know, really inspirational that he's still that good at 74 and can get out there and perform and sing like he does. And there's a lot of differing opinions, depending upon you who you ask in the Deep Purple camp, if they are done or not. And they are calling the tour the long goodbye, and they really just don't know. You know, they know the end is near, but they also know that they are up there in years. Some of them do have various health ailments that they're dealing with, including Ian Gillan. So they know, you know, they love doing it. They know the band still sounds good, but they do want to get out before the band doesn't sound good anymore. And they are very cognizant of that. So they're kind of taking it tour by tour, week by week, show by show. And I had a tremendous time touring Mexico with them. Unfortunately, four of the shows on the tour were canceled, the first two and the last two. So the good news was I got home earlier than expected and got to have Thanksgiving at home. And I hope everybody did have a good Thanksgiving last Thursday in the U.S. But the experience of traveling with them, flying with them on their charter plane, staying in wonderful hotels, and introducing Deep Purple was amazing. One of the things that quick story here. The first couple shows of the tour, I didn't do anything on stage before Purple because I had heard from their team that they never let anybody introduce them. Fair enough. I get it. So I didn't do that. Met a ton of great Mexican fans and did what I did, and that was that. And then as time went on and we were having dinners and we were hanging out with all the guys in purple, I brought up to them the fact is like, you know, they mentioned something to me because I was introducing the opening band In Flames. I said, I'd love to introduce you guys, but I know you have a policy, you know, nobody on the stage. And they said, oh, no, not for you. We would let you do it. And I was like, really? Well, let's do that. And we talked about it. And, you know, basically what had happened was they had had, like a lot of bands, some instances where, you know, people that are total tools go out on stage before the band plays and say stupid things or act like idiots or, you know, just don't know how to handle themselves bringing on a band. And it just turned them off. So Ian Gillan told me that it had been like 40 years since they let anybody introduce them and go on stage before they played. But they said to me, oh, no, you're different. We would love for you to do it. And I was like, wow, I'm honored. So I said, so what do we want to do? How do you want to do this? So I proposed the idea, and I'd done this a few times before with UFO and some other bands, where I literally introduce each band member as they come out by name and then say, please welcome Deep Purple. So Deep Purple actually scrapped their intro tape and had me walk out on stage, say hello to the crowd, introduce each of the five members. As I did, they walked out and started noodling on their instruments. And as I said, ladies and gentlemen, Deep Purple, they kicked right into Highway Star. You don't know how cool it is to be on a stage with Deep Purple literally standing behind you as they begin to play Highway Star. I mean, just incredible. And the guys were super cool. And then they loved it. They were like, you know, oh, mate, the introduction's brilliant. I love the way that works. Do it again. So I did it like 3-4 times. Then the tour got cut a little bit short for reasons still somewhat unknown. And, you know, there it is. I told them I'll happily go on tour with you if you continue, though, just to do the intro. Great guys. Great experience. I had lunch with Roger Glover. I had dinner with Ian Paice. Spent time with Steve Morse, Don Airey, Ian Paice. Just amazing. Amazing. So, and thank you to all the great fans I met in Mexico. So many fans. So excited I was there. Really, really very cool. And to Deep Purple and their camp, and a shout out to In Flames as well. The opening act had a lot of fun with those guys. So the interview for you this week is with Ian Gillan. This interview made a lot of news because I also talked to Ian about his time in Black Sabbath, which got picked up by some of the news outlets. And we did this, I forget what the city was. It may have been in San Luis Potosi, the name of the city in Mexico we were in. We were in we're in the hotel in the business center, which we closed down. And Ian Gillan came in and gave me a good 45 minutes or so, which you're going to hear right now on the Eddie Trunk podcast. And as always, all the interviews you hear are courtesy of my daily radio show on Sirius XM Channel 106 on the channel volume, which is heard live Monday through Friday, 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time, and replays every night 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern Time, and is also always available on demand on the Sirius XM app. So all the interviews you hear originated and aired there live, and I cherry pick one each week to bring you here on the podcast. So you get a little sense of the things that I'm doing over there on volume on a daily basis. Also, if you're listening to this on post-day Thursday, speaking of Sirius XM, you know, once a month I'm going to L.A. and doing my show from the Rainbow in L.A. and doing a special live broadcast from the patio there. And that will happen tonight. So if you're in Southern California, come by the Rainbow, 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific time. Don't need a ticket. Totally free. No guest list. Just show up. And I'll be there doing the radio show live again, 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific time tonight. If you're not in Southern California, you can listen to all the action live on Sirius XM Channel 106 on volume. As usual, at Eddie Trunk, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, eddietrunk.com is the website with all my appearances on the homepage. Coming up December 8th, I'm back in Tulsa at the IDL Ballroom for LA Guns and Junkyard. And I also have some other stuff. It'll all be posted on the website as it's confirmed and comes in as we start to wind down the year for 2018. Follow on Twitter for sure, where I am most active for up to the second news info and updates at Eddie Trunk. Also, a quick note, if you're looking to order signed copies of my books for the holidays, which people often do, hit the books tab for order info on eddietrunk.com. But please note, I only have copies of Volume 2 to sell currently. Orders for Volume 1 will not be processed. I have no more copies of that. I am unable to get more copies of it at the moment. So only Volume 2, if you're interested in ordering a personalized signed book, are now available. Just go to the books tab. And also, if you're looking for gifts, check out the merch store on eddietrunk.com. Trunk Nation, Eddie Trunk shirts, hats, and a lot more. So let's get into it. Let's talk to Ian Gillan, one of the legends of rock. He is on this week with us right after this on the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
The Eddie Trunk Podcast.
TheraWorks Relief. I've been telling you about it. I got it sitting right on my counter in my bathroom. If you or a loved one get leg or foot cramps, you know how painful they can be. I had one that woke me up out of a sound sleep, and it is brutal. It can interrupt your daily life and really, really make you uncomfortable. Check it out. TheraWorks Relief, a non-greasy foam that's proven to relieve muscle cramps fast, and it'll reduce muscle soreness. And with daily use, TheraWorks Relief can even prevent muscle cramps before they start, so you can get a full night's sleep and do all the activities you love without worry. TheraWorks Relief, it only takes minutes to apply. It absorbs quickly, and it truly works. People love the results. So check it out. You've probably seen Dr. Drew Pinsky on TV talking about TheraWorks Relief, and many of my colleagues on radio are also talking about it. TheraWorks Relief. Now the holiday seasons, they're right around the corner, so if you know someone who suffers with muscle cramps or muscle soreness, how can you possibly get them a better gift than some relief from pain? TheraWorks Relief, it is the choice for preventing and relieving muscle cramps. Make it yours. Get TheraWorks Relief today in the pain relief aisle at Walmart, CVS, Rite Aid, and Walgreens, or by talking to your pharmacist. Learn more at TheraWorksRelief.com.
Podcast One is your one-stop shop for everything TV and pop culture.
A very candid, not even supposed to be on the record conversation.
Check out any of the Collider Network podcasts, like TV Talk, Movie Talk, Collider Live, and more. And for you reality TV fans, Rob's sister Nino's got you covered with Rob Has a Podcast.
This is a podcast about nothing. Yeah. You literally have a podcast about nothing.
Check out the Collider Network and Rob Has a Podcast every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hey, be sure to check out Zane's World on Podcast One. World traveler, author, and alcohol aficionado Zane Lamprey is well learned in the art of having a good time as he reviews the best attractions and destinations on the globe and shares the craziest stories behind his travels. Check out Zane's World every Tuesday on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Eddie Trunk back with you, and it's time for this week's interview, and it is with, as I mentioned, Ian Gillan of Deep Purple, who has fronted the band through all of their classic best-known period of all the big records and has in recent years as well, including some great recent albums that they made as well. So let's let the man go at it. And man, we just was such a great honor and such a great conversation. I hope you enjoyed it. I enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoy doing it. So from Mexico, from my volume show on Sirius XM, this is Ian Gillan. Thank you for coming. I knew you came a long distance for this.
Yeah, I did. I came all the way downstairs from my room.
A push of the button on the elevator. They should all be that easy, right?
Via the cafe where I picked up a cappuccino, yeah.
Okay. Well, I was talking about it on the air. Thank you for, we had an amazing dinner the other day. I really appreciate you having me for that.
And that was fun.
It was fun. You taught me the proper way to drink the Sambuca and the cappuccino, although I forgot the order.
Yeah, I forget too.
But you said your dad taught you
my
that.
My dad taught me all about chasers with beer and whiskey, but after a few, I forgot what was chasing what. But he was from Scotland, and there's a line in a song I wrote, my daddy was from Scotland, and I couldn't understand a single word he said to me until I was a man. It was the Glaswegian accent is very harsh.
Oh, yeah.
Everything sounds like a threat.
I bet. That's interesting, like a threat. Tell me how you're feeling now about this, which is your final go-through. You know, the tour is called The Long Goodbye. You're still Infinite is still obviously the new record you're still supporting as well. But how are you feeling about things as to where the band's at right now? I've seen two shows now on this tour. I think I was talking earlier, I mean, the band still sounds so powerful. You still sound so great singing. How are you feeling about things and how things are going with all this as far as A Long Goodbye?
Well, deep inside, it's quite a philosophical, psychological thing to deal with. When you come to a point, I mean, a couple of years ago when Ian Paice had his stroke, we were all feeling a bit under the weather and feeling our age a bit, and recognized the fact that the end was not that far away. And so we decided to call it the Long Goodbye Tour, long being the word. And now we're all feeling great. So I imagine we'll try and keep going for a little longer. So long as the result is great and we feel powerful and delivering the goods. But it's in the back of your mind, the end. I think it must be for everyone when you come up to retirement or the end of a long career. You just think it's a kind of shadow in the future because you don't quite know what's going to happen when you do quit. But we'll handle that when we get there. In the meantime, everyone's on top of their game and enjoying it. So there's been talk of another album, and so that would be lovely, I think, if we're in the right mood and the right shape to do it.
Well, we were just talking off the air about the technology of me being able to do a live broadcast to America and Canada here in Mexico with you today, and that technology also permeates with what you do in music. You were saying you can actually write on the road and or times carry mobile studios, and that's been part of the creative process.
I can do a lot of that, and in fact I do. I've got a friend of mine, Steve Morris from Liverpool, I do a lot of writing with, and he comes down to my place in Portugal, and we just set up. He just pulls a laptop out and we stick a microphone into a little box and off we go. But that's for writing. With Deep Purple, we need a few things. First of all, we need Bob Ezrin. And as we've got Ian Paice, we need a big room because his drums need to sound big and they need to be recorded live with all the ambient sound as well as the close miking. So it's a combination. When digital recording first came in, where everyone switched over to it without really knowing how to do it. When I first heard Machine Head on a CD in 1982, I nearly cried. It was so awful. It sounded so flat and terrible. Years later, when they got to grips with it and they learned how to remaster and learned how to use digital recording, it was very similar. The difference between the filmic quality on a video and video, which was always very cold in the early days, the visually cold, but it didn't have those warm textures. And so it's the same with recording. And then most people moved into a situation where you're using 2-inch tape, analog 24 track to record, and then switching to digital for mixing. So now they've pretty much got him nailed. They're still using 2-inch tape for recording because it's got that. You can't match the sound. You just can't. And I guess, Bob can. The people I know can't. So it's developing, it's evolving. It makes it a lot easier now. But you still need the room, you still need the organic side of things.
Yeah, I mean, that's so important. And you know, you mentioned Bob Ezrin, who I had on this show not too long ago, who's a legendary producer and just such a fascinating guy to talk to. You first started working with him
on the previous record, right? On What If. That was the first record you did with him?
What If. This is a great title for an album. It was Now What, actually.
Now What. What? I'm sorry.
No, that's all right.
Now What. That was the first time, right?
That's when we first saw Darkness on the Horizon. We go, Now What?
But talk about what he brought to the band, because for all the people that love what Ezrin does, there are also some that say he's a bit of a... Well, I mean, I think that's why people want him, because he's a bit of a taskmaster and he can be a bit hard on you and things like that. How do you find working with him? What has he brought to Deep Purple?
Okay, well, I can't think of any negatives with Bob. Number one, we all respect him because he's been around the block so many times.
Mm-hmm.
He's a consummate musician himself. He's produced everything from classical music to hard rock.
I think he has a Bocelli record right now that he produced.
Yes.
Which is it's incredible scope of what he does.
Everything that comes out is quality, and everything that comes out is considered. But for us in particular, what he gave us was something I remember at the first meeting we had in Toronto when he came to see a show. Before we worked with him, he said, what I'd like to do is, he said, I saw the show last night. He said, I'd like to capture that on the record, because that's what you used to do. You used to just go in and jam and make songs out of the jam. And it was so right, because the music always came first. Before the song, if you know what I mean, before the song, the lyrics and the tune and everything else, it was just the excitement, exciting interchange between the guys, the rhythm section and the soloists, who each slotted back into the rhythm section when they weren't soloing. So he let us loose in the studio with freedom. We don't want 3-minute songs. We don't want 5-minute songs. You can play for 10 minutes if you want. On the other hand, he would say, enough, let's get rid of that. So as soon as he heard us going up a blind alley, he put a stop to it. And everyone said, cool, that's great. Because Deep Purple's never had a leader in the band, and nobody ever.
And that's a big point, that you guys as a band said, cool. That's cool, that's great. That's maybe where the pushback with other bands, you were willing to take that.
Absolutely. There's no point, you know, having a dog and barking yourself. It doesn't make any sense. So we never had a leader in the band, so we would spend days pursuing ideas that were never going to get anywhere sometimes, just because it seemed the right thing to do. Bob had good insight and foresight, and he was able to put a stop to all the time wasting. So we were able to make records in 10 days just by going in and doing what we do. We arrive at noon and we finish at 6. We take a break for tea at 3 o'clock, and whatever's good, we record it. And then Roger and I do some work on the tune side of things and the lyrical side of things. But once the music is nailed, we work on top of that.
You know what's incredible to me is a band like Deep Purple with the catalog that you have, whether, you know, going back to the beginning, as you mentioned, Machine Head Alone, I mean, wherever you want to go in the band's history, you easily could go out and play these shows without making new music or making a new album. But it's important to continue to be creative and continue to write, even at this point in your career as an artist, I assume.
Yes. I think it's important because that's the difference between being cabaret and contemporary.
Nostalgia versus...
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. You've got to have input. There are four elements to... we talked about this before. There are four elements to a Deep Purple show. One is the well-known material from the past, and that'll be anything from Highway Star to Perfect Strangers, etc. Or anything from Hush to Perfect Strangers and stuff like that. Then there's the more obscure material that we slip in that the fans know, like Bloodsucker and Lazy and things like that, that were never got played on the radio, but the real Deep Purple fans like to hear them. Then there's new material, which we try and balance with the old stuff, and it has been difficult at times because it's not compatible, and that's why it slips in and out of the show quite quickly. But now, with Now What and with Infinite, the songs are much more compatible with the earlier material because of the way in which they were developed in the studio, the freedom. And, of course, the other element of new songs is that, you know, they were all new songs once, so we have to do new songs in order for them to become old songs. So right. You've got to give them a chance. And the fourth element is the improvisations, which is throws a challenge. I get butterflies in my stomach every lunchtime on show day. It's not stage fright, but I do get nervous excitement because I don't quite know what's going to happen on stage that night. There's always something different that keeps you on your toes, and that keeps the show fresh. And the fifth element, of course, is the audience and the venue, and the, you know, that changes every night. So
does it amaze you, the audience, that this band, like here in Mexico, these crowds seem so into it, and I've gone out there in that crowd and met some fans, and it's very diverse. The ages are wide range of people that have been touched by your music. The reaction, and you do, it does, of course, people want to hear Highway Star and Smoke on the Water and all that, but it just seems like they are open to going on that journey that you guys bring, whether it be an extended jam or whether it be a new song. They seem a lot, very receptive to it, at least here on this tour.
I think they are generally around the world. We noticed about 20 years ago that there was a huge influx of young people coming to the shows, and the old ones were spreading to the outside of the arenas and the seats, and the young ones were filling up the space in the front. Which, you know, because they bring energy. They bring a lot of energy, young fans. And so I like that blend. And it's nice to see them all work. There's no embarrassment about age groups with Deep Purple audiences, I don't think. And it's not like other sort of genres where you have to wear the right hat or have the right haircut. You know, it's not like that at all. And I think they like us for our honesty, the music's honesty. It's right on the edge. It's quite challenging, and it's enjoyable to listen to, I think, you know, because there's a lot of melody and texture and exciting rhythms. The band is full of energy. I mean, it's a very energetic show.
It's so powerful.
It goes from beginning to, you know, and I think the fans, you know, if they want to jump up and down, they can do that.
How do you feel about yourself at this point? One of the things I was talking to Roger the other day, and Steve as well, and I said, "Man, Ian, vocally sounding great. You're going for some of that high stuff, even in some of these songs." And I think Roger or Steve made a comment to me, something to the effect of, "Like I think he has settled into a sort of a new voice, if you will." Talk a little bit about that. I mean, what you did. I don't expect you anytime soon to be singing Child in Time again. But I mean, what you're doing is pretty remarkable. You sound great. I mean, what sort of process do you go through these days to do that?
Well, we don't expect Pavarotti to be doing nine high C's in Ah, Mes Amis from La Fille du Régiment at the Met anymore, because he's dead. But even in his later years, he wasn't able to do that. Child in Time for me was more like an Olympic event than a song. It was... It was quite a challenge.
When was the last time you sang it?
I think in my late 30s.
Okay.
I wound it down when it was becoming difficult, and I didn't want it to sound difficult. It's not our job to air our problems to the public. We've got to make things seem effortless, mm-hmm. and that's the way it should be. So, but. Every cloud comes with a silver lining. And so when I was in my late 40s, early 50s, I found another voice. I found the voice I'd always been searching for, which was a high mid-range. One of my heroes as a kid was a singer called Cliff Bennett, who was a West London singer, had a couple of big hits in the early days. And I used to go and watch him. And the power he had in the high mid-range, just by singing naturally, was very impressive. I could never get that tone. I could reach it, but it never sounded convincing to me. And then all of a sudden my voice matured a bit and I got a change of tone and it sounded good. So you work within the parameters that you're comfortable with. Mm. And so yes, I have found a new voice. I think up to a point it's not that different. It's just changed shape slightly.
Yeah, no, it's remarkable and it works. And it's, you know, we touched on earlier about knowing when to say when. I have a thing that I say all the time, like the bands that I love, I'd rather see them end still sounding great than going to see them say, Jesus, why are they still doing it? Like they just can't do it anymore. And I walked away from at least these first two shows that I've seen with you guys saying, they can still do it just fine. I mean, they really can. It's incredible after all these years that's the case. So you feel like you could have another couple years here with this, or?
Well, I'm hoping so. At the moment, you never. Yeah, the answer to that is yes. But you never know what's around the corner.
Yeah.
So we're philosophical about that, and we'll take it as it comes.
Do these shows have different meaning to you now? Not to say that the others didn't, but knowing that these, no matter what, it's kind of the final lap. These you feel a little differently after you do them.
Eddie, I got to let you into a secret. Really, this is. It probably sounds very selfish and whatever. We were talking about the fans earlier. But you know what? Deep Purple never did anything except for itself. And you have to satisfy yourself, first of all. And if we come off, I've had this many, 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 many times over the years when the band's all grumpy in the dressing room and the manager comes in and says, oh, great show, man. You know, the crowd went crazy and everything else. And we're all going, yeah, because we know it wasn't right. We know somebody screwed up. Somebody wasn't on it. Tonight, if you're sick, we can cover. But if you're not, you need to kick up the backside. And so we set the standards high for ourselves. And it's working at the moment. So there's a very happy atmosphere in the dressing room. So the answer to your question is, it's if we're happy, we'll carry on. But our standards are high. So we've always been stage performers. The reason we're doing this at the moment and keeping... I don't know if you've seen the schedule for the last 6 months, but it's crazy.
You're just in Japan. You just toured with Priest in America.
Russia, Europe. I mean, Scandinavia. I mean, it's just been insane the last 6 months. And so that keeps you on your toes. What do they say? Use it or lose it, you know.
Right.
And I think we do use it a lot.
Back with more with Ian Gillan coming up on this week's Eddie Trunk Podcast.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Hey, let me tell you guys about Vivid Seats. It is an online event ticket marketplace, and it's dedicated to providing fans of live entertainment with the experience that lasts a lifetime. Vivid Seats, the listeners, my listeners, you can watch your favorite team or favorite artist perform in person. Vivid Seats helps fans find their seats to any of their favorite live events, including sports, concerts, theater, and more. And Vivid Seats offers great prices and an easy purchasing experience. And check this out. Use the Eddie Trunk Podcast. You guys, the listeners, you can receive 10% off your first purchase with Vivid Seats. Here's all you do. Go to the App Store or Google Play. You download the Vivid Seats app. First time new customers, you can enter the promo code Eddie, E-D-D-I-E, and you'll get 10% off your order. All Vivid Seats confirm orders. They're backed by 100% guaranteed. So they're all confirmed. They're all guaranteed once they are. All you got to do, grab the app, put my name in, my first name, Eddie, E-D-D-I-E, 10% off. That could be a lot of money. So check it all out. We all love a night out. You all want to see your favorite bands, your favorite sporting event, whatever the case may be. Use Vivid Seats. Grab the app. First-time customers, promo code Eddie, E-D-D-I-E, enter it, 10% off your first Vivid Seats orders. Every purchase, backed by 100% buyer guarantee, from the biggest concerts and games to the hottest theater and more, Vivid Seats. Grab the app, enter Eddie, 10% off your first order. Enjoy, folks. Vivid Seats. Check it out.
Hey, guys, it's Jack Vanek from The Lady Gang, and I am sitting here with true crime TV producer and my best friend, Alexis Linkletter, and we are so excited that we are finally launching our true crime podcast called The First Degree right here on Podcast One. And each week, we are going to bring you the craziest true crime stories and talk to the people who are one degree away from each of these crazy events. And we've dragged crime journalist Billy Jensen along for the ride, and he can't get rid of us. Join us on The First Degree every Wednesday on podcast1.com and the PC One app. Also, remember to rate and review.
"60 seconds. That is exactly how long this commercial lasts. Well, not really, give or take a few seconds. But you know what else you can do in about a minute?
You can get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. And the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a true cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions, and you'll get an accurate true cash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in, and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get the answers you need, so there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you are ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today.
This is the Eddie Trunk Podcast.
Let's get back to it with more with Ian Gillen on this week's Eddie Trunk Podcast. Steve Morse is going to be here in a bit. Can you believe you've had Steve 25 years, Ian?
Yeah, I can. It's great. It's been a great journey. When he came on board, he reignited the band. We were a pretty low ebb. I mean, Joe Satriani saved us from drowning completely and got us out of the hole. But it was Steve was there to help us rebuild with the Perpendicular album. And from there on, we embarked on a completely different regime, a different way of working and everything else. He's been great.
Yeah. And he just does such a brilliant job in the band. I think when he first came into the band, it was probably rough for him, right? I mean, yeah. Coming in and, you know, anybody coming in after Blackmore would have been a tough thing. But it seems like the audience has really, you know, embraced what he brings now.
Let's remember a couple of things. Deep Purple was sinking with Richie. It was going, we were playing to quarter houses in Europe, which is, one of our strongest territories in Germany. Smaller venues, and they weren't even full. So had we continued that way, had Richie not walked out, we would have finished. That would have been the end of it. So, and the other thing was Steve's answer to that question when we did our first press conferences. And when somebody asked him, he said, how's it going to feel to fill Richie Blackmore's shoes? And he said, as far as I know, Richie took his shoes with him when he left the band.
So. Steve just walked in, so only say nice things about him. He can hear us right now. Oh, shit, we have to be careful what we say now. No, nothing but love for Steve Morse, of course, and what he's brought to this. I want to ask you about a couple other things, though, before I let you get on with your day. You had a band after you initially left Deep Purple that was just called Gillen with Bernie Torme and all.
Yeah.
That band, unfortunately, never really took root in America, did it? You could never really get that over there. Did that bother you at that point?
That really never took root anywhere, to be honest. That was it was a kind of nebulous situation. It started off with a kind of, I don't know how to describe it, a kind of jazz rock formation. I just got together some musicians that I truly respected, and you can never cater for human chemistry. Because you don't know what's going to... You feed it. That's why everyone failed when their attempts to make supergroups in the 70s. You know, you feed in all these different elements, and what comes out the other end is entirely due to the way they blend. So it was good music, but it wasn't very commercial. And so I did two albums with the first incarnation, and then a few more with Gillen and the Ian Gillen Band. And it was never quite settled. It did very well. But it was a journey. It was an onward journey, and very invigorating for me to get back into the business. I had a complete break for a couple of years after Purple. It was impossible to find anything that would fit Purple. And then ended up with a fantastic record label, Virgin, in London. In those days, was just amazing. And we ended up doing a tour in the UK with the Gillen Band. And I went for an Indian meal with one of my heroes, Rodney Marsh, who was the a football player for Queen's Park Rangers and England. He was an international player. We went for a meal after the show, and he said, oh, man, he said, that was great, fantastic show. He said, it's a great band. And then a pause. He said, but it's not as good as Deep Purple, is it? Rodney was one of those guys that spoke his mind, and we'd had a couple of drinks, so in Venus Veritas, as they say. And So he was right, and the band was coming to its organic end anyway. So I picked up the phone to John Lord the next morning and said, what do you think? And he was all for it. And at that time, my band came to a natural end, and the word went around, and we thought, yeah, maybe it's worth it. Let's check it out. And everyone had different obligations. Richie was up to here with Rainbow at the time, and so we gave it a year, and then the seeds were sown the day after that night, that show in the Hammersmith Odeon. And
that led to Perfect Strangers.
That led to Perfect Strangers after a year with Black Sabbath here.
Well, and I don't want to gloss over that because, when you came in to SiriusXM and you, Roger, and Ian came in and we did the launch for the Infinite Record and we spoke, as you and I were walking out of the building down the elevator, I don't know if you recall, but I'd gotten in your ear about something about Born Again, and you and I stood in the lobby and chatted for a bit while everyone was in the car waiting for you. Mm. But that album, you know, on the air, I'd like to talk about it because that album, although at the time was fairly maligned for various reasons, over the 35 years, I guess, since it's been made, has taken on a whole new stature. People really like that record. Some have pointed to it as like the roots of what would become grunge in some ways further down the line. What is your memories and what are your thoughts now in retrospect about your time in Sabbath and making that record?
Well, I was talking earlier about human chemistry and how what you put in one end is not necessarily what comes out the other. And how we started was just because we got drunk together one night. I went for a drink with Tony and Giza, and they said, oh, well, what ended up under the table? And I can't remember much of what happened, but I got a call from my manager the next day saying, don't you think you should call me if you're going to make big decisions like this? I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, apparently I just got a call. You agreed to join Sabbath last night.
Oh, all right.
So that's how it happened. And I was at a kind of loose end anyway, having just finished with my own band and Purple not really being anything viable at the time. So we set a one-year plan, and that was to do an album and a tour. Nobody knew what was going to happen, so we pitched up, and I pitched my tent, literally, at the Old Manor in Oxfordshire, and we made an album. I didn't see much of them. They were night people, so they slept all day and worked all night. I got up in the morning, cooked my breakfast, went to the studio to hear what they had recorded the night before, and wrote a song over it. And and that's how the album was made. It was an interesting structure, management-wise, with Don Arden and all the old-style kind of overtones of gangsterism and stuff like that and connections. So it was interesting, and I loved it. It was a challenge for me. It was a bit like, and this sounds weird, but it was a bit like doing Jesus Christ Superstar or singing with Pavarotti. It's just something completely different.
You've done.
Yeah, but I mean, listen, Tony is such a great writer. You know what to expect with Tony. There's no multi-directional approach. It's just, you know, he is the father of everything that came out of Seattle, I believe. You know, mm-hmm. He is just, he's just very direct. And that's how he evolved from early days. So I found it very easy to sing, write songs with them. And we had a couple of good ones based on, there was always a narrative. My favorite song from that album is Trashed, which is a true story.
Which you redid later with Tony on Gillan's Inn when you did that record a number of years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that was a true story about a racetrack and too much drink and spinning a car, crashing it and going upside down. And it was exciting times. And then the tour, which was the longest party I've ever been to, I must say.
Well, you told me at dinner the other day a story about the stage set and how that came about, the Stonehenge, if you could share that.
We had a production company called Light and Sound Design. They were in Birmingham, where the band was based. And after a rehearsal one day, we had a kind of meeting to go to their office. And as we were walking through these corridor, one of the guys said, by the way, anyone got any idea of concept for a stage set or anything? And Geezer Butler said, yeah, Stonehenge. And the guy said, wow, that's great. He said, how do you visualize it? And Geezer said, well, life size, of course. So we didn't quite go life size, but it was about two-thirds, I think, of your average your average block of stone. And we could never get it all up on the stage. We played some huge arenas and places, I mean, stadiums, and you couldn't get it. Stonehenge, you know, come on. So there are parts of it. There are monoliths that are still lying around in Dockland somewhere, potted around the world, as far as I know. And it was funny, and there are loads of hilarious stories attached to that. It was one long party, and I think a joy. I'm still very close with Tony, and we speak. And
well, you guys do a really nice benefit. It was for Armenian schools, right? You did a record not too
long. Yeah, after the earthquake, when 25,000 killed. You know, it wasn't widely reported because it was just on the cusp of the end of the Soviet Union, and Armenia was a Soviet republic at that time, not a free country. And so we didn't hear much about it. And but I was there a year after, and I saw the devastation. And I saw an old lady just holding up a picture of her family, 28 people, great-grandchildren. She was the only survivor. And I spoke to the mayor of Spitak, and he said, for a year, he said, there's been no music. No music on the radio, no music in the church. Even the birds have stopped singing. And after a devastation like that, and a little thing went off in my head and said, well, maybe when you're ready, we can start the music again and start with the music. And in the neighboring town, Gyumri, the school had been devastated. There were holes in the wall. The snow was coming in. The kids were frozen. The instruments were broken. And we went prior to that, after my first experience, we made an album called Live Aid Armenia. And for that, the president gave us an award, Appreciation Award, Medal of Honor. And when we went to receive that, on the plane on the way back, Tony and I thought, let's rebuild that school because now's the time for the music to start again. So it was all very symbolic as well as, and it kind of took off, and everyone climbed on board, and it was wonderful. And I was there when the school was opened, and the president was there, and the prime minister was there, and the archbishop from New York was there, and it was just very emotional time. And a friend of ours in Canada who has a music store in a small town donated a truckload of equipment. There were pianos and violins and drums and woodwind and brass and guitar picks and strings and everything you could possibly imagine. It was just fantastic. So a very emotional time, and it's all up and running now, and everyone's happy.
That's amazing. Two quick things, and I'll let you go. You relaunched a band you had prior to Purple, is that correct? The Javelins?
Well, it was my first ever band. It was my amateur days in 1962 and 63, called The Javelins, yeah. And we used to play songs by Buddy Holly and Chuck Berry and Elvis and the Coasters and the Everly Brothers and you name it. And so we got together in March and recorded an album in 2 days. They practiced for 6 weeks. None of them turned pro. They were all, one was a cab driver, one was a printer, one was an architect.
And you stayed in touch with all of them?
Over the years, yeah. We had a reunion, a sort of 50-year reunion a few years ago. And we kind of stayed in touch.
That's amazing in and of itself, because here it is, this band you had as a kid, and you go on to become, you know, Ian Gillan, Deep Purple and all that, and these guys are driving cabs, and you kept the connection and started it up again.
It's a kind of milestone in your life, and it's a significant point where you start to learn a bit more than just being a fan singing Buddy Holly songs. You know, you suddenly think there's something in there, and the joy of performing and learning and watching other professionals around you and in nearby venues and picking up tricks of the trade and going to Jim Marshall's shop and mixing with the pros and watching Cliff Bennett and thinking, I want to be there right in the middle of the stage. I can't get any closer. I'm on the front standing there watching, but I want to be where he is in the middle of the rebel rousers, hearing, you know, Chas Hodges and Roy Young and Mickey Burt and all these players right in my ear. That's where I want to be. And so I treasure those days, and I treasure the memories. It was a great launch pad, a great springboard for me.
Last thing, Smoke on the Water. Be honest with me. You sick of singing it?
I have got about the best anecdote for that that I could ever tell anybody.
I'm sure you've been asked it before, but...
Well, I never quite knew how to answer that other than truthfully, but boringly, until I sang with Pavarotti, and he wanted to do an album with me, and he wanted to sing Smoke on the Water. When he called me at home, "Hello, Ian, we're going to sing together. What should we sing? Child in Time?" I'm going, "I don't know. Those days are gone. How about Ness and Dorma?" He went, it went quiet on the phone. He said, "Ness and Dorma? You crazy? You want to sing Ness and Dorma with me? You crazy?" So he said a bit more than that. There were a couple of epithets involved. But anyway, when we were rehearsing, he was an amazing man, amazing, full of humanity and great sense of humor. And he wanted to be a pop singer. He wanted music on the streets. That's why he did what he did within the world of opera. And he said, "Ian, I'm so jealous of you. I've heard you sing Smoke on the Water 6 times now. Every time is different." He said, "Sometimes you're driving it, sometimes you're laid back." He said, "It's different in the smallest way, but every time." He said, "If I did that to any of my famous arias, if I ever moved one smidgen, one iota from the original interpretation, the critics and the fans would crucify me. Wow. My career would be over." He said, "So you have freedom." I remember that remark, and I thought, well, that's true. I wish I'd thought of saying that. But it doesn't have quite the weight or the profundity when it's coming from me as it does if I quote Pavarotti. And so I do that all the time when I'm asked that question. It never bores me. It's a great lyric. It's a narrative. It's a true story.
Did you know when you recorded that song, when that came together, the music, the lyric, the day you recorded it, was there anything in your fiber that said, this is going to become one of the classic rock, the biggest classic rock songs in the history of rock music, essentially?
No idea at all. We had no idea about commerciality with Purple. I'm not sure we still do. it's a bit beyond our reach. That's not how we write our music, with commerce in mind. But I loved singing it. The song was an addition to... We were short of time. Martin Birch, our engineer producer, said, "Guys, we've got one more day in the studio and we're 7 minutes short of an album." And so we dug out the tape that we'd made for the sound check on the first day, which was Smoke on the Water. It wasn't called that then. It was called Dan Dan Song or something like that. And so Roger and I wrote a biographical lyric, the story of making Machine Head. Will came out to Montreux and the Lake Geneva shoreline to make records for the Mobile, the Rolling Stones truck thing.
Great.
And then the fire, of course, and the Frank Zappa concert. And it was all encapsulated in the lyrics. But the riff, you know, was just awesome. And no, we didn't think of that. So just thank God we were able to finish the album before we got thrown out by the police because we were making too much noise late into the night in this hotel where we had to record because the casino had burnt down where we were supposed to record.
Yeah.
And it was some time later when a guy called Russ Shaw at Warner Brothers came to see the show, saw how well that song was going down, and went back and did an edit to 3 minutes 15 and got played on the radio for the first time.
Oh, I didn't realize there was an edit of it.
Yeah, well, the album version is 7 minutes long.
Yeah, but still, that's...
It was never played.
The album version wasn't?
No.
All I know is the album version.
Yeah, it was never played. I mean, not on commercial radio.
Right.
It was never played at all until the edit was done. And then, of course, they had a three and a half minute song that they could fit in.
Yeah.
That became format happy, you know.
Yeah.
So that's how it came about. No, never got bored with it, and we had no idea how it was going to turn out or how well it was going to be received. We knew that the song went down well on stage, but not until thank God for record labels and radio stations, eh?
And it still does, man. Just last night, hearing every Mexican fan out there singing that chorus back to you, it's unbelievable. It really is unbelievable. So, listen, man, Steve is standing here. I could talk to you for hours, and we've got a couple more weeks here together, so feel free to drop by anytime.
And, I love you, Eddie. Thanks very much for being here. Anyway, we're enjoying having you on the road.
I can't thank you enough, and I appreciate you dropping by for a few. Enjoy your massage. I know you're going to get. And
yeah, these old aching bones.
And I'll see you, I think, tomorrow. We're going to Lyon,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we'll see you in Lyon, and thank you so much, Ian Gillan.
Okay, buddy.
Well, my huge thanks to Ian Gillan of Deep Purple, also to his assistant Sally for making all that happen. We did that on day off in Mexico on the band's recent tour, and it was a tremendous honor. Could have spoken to the guy for hours and hours and hours. Thank you guys for listening to the Eddie Trunk Podcast. Again, if you're in LA and you're listening to this on Thursday, post-day, the 29th of November, I will be at the Rainbow in Los Angeles tonight doing my radio show on volume, live from the Rainbow, 6 to 8 p.m. Pacific. Come on down, totally free, don't even need a ticket. And if you are not in the LA area, be sure to tune in and listen live on Channel 106. On SiriusXM, major special guest. We've had some great guests, and I can guarantee you tonight will be no exception. So be sure to tune in. And again, tonight, the live show is usually 2 to 4 Eastern with the replay 9 to 11 Eastern. On Thursdays, the one time a month, we do the show from the Rainbow. We flip that best of show in 2 to 4 Eastern window, and the live broadcast tonight over the air is also 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern because we'll be at the Rainbow. And, of course, every day, Monday through Friday, live 2 to 4, replay 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. At Eddie Trunk on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, eddietrunk.com is the website. You guys have yourselves a great week, and I'll see you next Thursday for another all-new episode. And thanks, of course, as always, to Katie Irizarry. Have a good one, everybody.
Podcast One Sports is your home for the Underdog Sports Network. Join Chris Horwedel and friends each week as they cover the biggest stories in sports with shows like Tales from the Association, the Underdog Sports NFL Show, and You're Wrong and Here's Why.
You can't rely on draft picks a lot of times with quarterbacks. There's 4 to 5 quarterbacks drafted in the first round that are complete busts.
Check out all these exciting shows on the Underdog Sports Network every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.